As I stood in the LA office of the FBI's bank robbery coordinator, veteran FBI agent Bill Rader pointed to a wall plastered with bank surveillance photos. Rader ticked off the nicknames of a rogues gallery of serial bank robbers. The Baby Bandits, the Big Nose Bandit, the Big Ears Bandit, the Skunk Bandit, the Ponytail Bandit, the Grandpa Bandit. Hello, I'm Robert Riggs with a story from inside the crime scene tape at what was the bank robbery capital of the world in the 1980s and 90s, Los Angeles, California. I met Bill Rader in 1997 while doing a series of stories about the upsurge in violent bank robberies across the United States. Bank tellers were being shot, and customers were taken hostage. California's takeover bank robbery epidemic was spreading across the nation. Rader, who spent most of his 33 years with the FBI on the bank robbery squad, dispatched agents to the scene of robberies, 28 in one day alone. After he retired, Rader wrote a book about his favorite cases titled Where the Money Is, True Tales from the Bank Robbery Capital of the World. He also provided technical advice for Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie Catch Me If You Can. Rader advised how actor Tom Hanks should dress and talk like an FBI agent did in the 1960s and 70s, and what a bullpen looked like back in those days when button-down FBI agents worked together in an open office at their desk. Rader assigned colorful monikers to wanted bank robbers based on their appearance, clothing, MO, or unusual habits. For example, the Spider-Man Bandit didn't scale walls. Rather, spider web-like tattoos on his forearms earned him the nickname. The colorful and quirky nicknames helped generate more news coverage and more tips by creating a picture in people's minds. Rader told me that the tradition of assigning memorable nicknames dated back to Jack the Ripper, who killed and mutilated prostitutes in late 19th century London. As Rader and I scanned the wall, he stopped dead on a surveillance photo of two bank robbers clad head to toe in black body armor and armed with assault rifles. Rader dubbed the pair the High Incident Bandits. They had shot up two banks in the San Fernando Valley a few months earlier. With an ominous foreshadowing, Rader told me they were not just dressed for a bank robbery, but for a confrontation. Indeed, a month later, the two heavily armed gunmen, dubbed the High Incident Bandits by Rader, shot it out with police after robbing a bank in North Hollywood. The running gun battle lasted 44 minutes. The pair were armed with thousands of rounds of ammunition and fully automatic assault rifles. Wounded officers lay bleeding, pinned down. Armed with 9mm pistols and 38 caliber revolvers, the police were no match. An order crackled across police radio transmissions to shoot for the head, as officers realized their rounds were bouncing off the robbers' body armor. In the end, both robbers were killed, and 12 police officers and 8 bystanders were wounded. It was a case of life imitating art. 2 years earlier, the movie Heat featured a similar paramilitary-style robbery and shootout in L.A. Written and directed by Michael Mann, Heat is a classic American crime film. It pits Al Pacino as an LAPD detective against Robert De Niro, who plays a career thief and the gang's leader. Now, Mann has teamed up with award-winning author Meg Gardner to write a suspenseful novel titled Heat 2. It tells the backstory of the character in the years before and after the iconic movie. Meg Gardner is my guest on this episode of True Crime Reporter. She is a New York Times bestselling author of 16 thrillers. Her previous novel, The Dark Corners of the Night, features FBI profiler Caitlin Hendricks, which is in development by Amazon Studios for a television series. Here's my interview with Meg Gardner.
Meg, welcome to the True Crime Reporter podcast. I want to talk to you about Heat 2 because Heat, the movie, really became something of life imitating art. I was doing a bank robbery series across the country, and 2 years after Heat, we had the North Hollywood shootout, which is the biggest bank robbery shootout in the history of the U.S. How much of Heat 2, the book now with Michael Mann, is inspired by real life events?
Enough to give two authors a head start in creating a thriller that we hope has feels authentic to the lives of the people who are on all sides of the law. So, Heat, the movie, famously is about a crew of highline bank robbers headed by Neil McCauley, played by Robert De Niro, and the LAPD homicide detective who is hot on their trail, Vincent Hanna, played by Al Pacino. And we wanted to make sure that the lives these people would be really living feel three-dimensional, feel vivid, feel real, that we could have readers understand through a thriller how people came to embrace bank robbery as their vocation in their minds, or as the way they put the food on the table, or look to a way to escape eventually around the world to someplace soft and dreamy, and how men like Hanna come to find that their purpose in life is hunting people who carry off huge bank scores. The more dangerous, the crazier, the darker, the better in their mind. That's what makes them go. So we talked to a lot of police officers and retired bank robbers to find out what their lives were like. Michael Mann grew up in Chicago, where much of the early action in the novel is set, and he became very good friends with a number of detectives on the Chicago police force. So that's where some of the ideas for Heat originated and grabbed hold of him and have never let go, even over the decades, so that we carried on.
Well, it was the quintessential American crime, you know, going back to Bonnie and Clyde and Pretty Boy Floyd and those types, but it seems today it's waned.
Bank robbery. Yes, there was, as you mentioned, especially in the 80s and 90s, there was a huge surge in bank robberies, especially in Southern California, for a number of reasons, including the ubiquity of freeways and bank branches placed conveniently close to a lot of getaway routes. Bank robbers who stole for money to feed their drug habit, perhaps, or used their drug habit as an excuse to get the rush from carrying out bank robberies. But the law enforcement wised up. Banks took extra precautions against that kind of thing, and it just went out of fashion.
Did you happen in your research to talk to Bill Rader? He was the legendary head of the bank robbery squad in L.A. for almost 33 years.
Did not, but that's a name I guess I should keep in my back pocket, because it's fascinating, and I know readers and viewers get really interested in figuring out why people do this, how they would carry it off. I think sometimes people enjoy the idea of watching a bank score, thinking, as McCauley tells bank customers in Heat, we are not here for your money. We're here for the bank's money, that your money is insured, which is a way of calming people who are being held at gunpoint while he's actually stealing a whole bunch of money. But that's part of the reason people might be curious about these stories.
Well, and you mentioned earlier the thrill of the hunt for the, in that case, the LAPD detective played by Al Pacino. You can still see that if you, and we've hung out with them, U.S. Marshals, the fugitive hunters, that still is out there. What do you think that is? That boy, they live it. They're obsessed just like the character in the movie and the book.
Oh, there are a lot of reasons why people find that purposeful as well as exhilarating. Maybe that's the combination for people who can do this job in the story. Hannah, in the prequel section, it becomes clear he grew up in rural Illinois, essentially, and knew he wanted to be somewhere else, didn't know how to, what he wanted to do, but knew he wanted to get out. And so running, chasing, trying to figure out what it was he was after leads him into the Marine Corps, leads him to the police force. But he gets so caught up in the idea of the chase, and he is a brilliant detective. So those rare moments when it's not just accumulating data or sitting at a desk sorting through, you know, evidence logs, when the pieces of evidence click and light up his understanding of the case and how to find someone, that's what makes him go. And I think that holds true for a lot of people. Plus, you don't sit just behind a desk going through Facebook profiles on your computer these days. So, you know, yeah. U.S. Marshals are out there.
So, as you know, I do nonfiction with a podcast and our television series, but you doing fiction, can you give us a sense, how do you get in the head of these characters you create? And do you use, is a lot of fodder for this, detectives and investigators you've met during your writing career? Where does this come from?
The love of writing has always been with me. And I've always been a fan of thriller fiction as well as nonfiction crime and suspense, but telling stories about people who are on the edge of life and death, where the stakes are extremely high, and losing can be deadly, and there's intense conflict, there's incredible passion, there's the roller coaster, high octane, pedal to the metal ride to find out what's going to happen at the end. That always thrilled me as a reader. So that's what I wanted to write. And yes, talking to people who do the jobs, who live in that world, is absolutely invaluable. That shows us what really goes on in their minds, their hearts, their workaday lives, their family lives and drama. Mm-hmm. So talking to people who do the job is really the very best way to really get inside the world. And this was something that Michael Mann has always insisted upon in all his work through television and film. And now the novel is really understanding a culture, whether it's the culture of law enforcement, the culture of outlaws in a particular venue, to ground the story in something that feels authentic. So yeah, for this book, we did talk to, we wrote out with the LAPD. And as I said, we got some inside expertise on how to carry out a bank tunnel job.
Well, I don't want to spoil the book, but will we see another shootout?
Another shootout. If readers are curious, well, golly, let's see. It's set in an era when certainly the bank robbers weren't walking in with Nerf guns, and it's not too spoilery to say that that the Macaulay's crew goes up against a drug cartel, and those folks aren't known for handing out ice cream cones.
Okay. Well, now they walk into banks with computer cyber tools.
Exactly, and likewise, the Chicago Police Department is in the story. They're after a home invasion crew, which is very violent, and so yes, they are armed and ready.
Well, you talked earlier about the life and death glimpse of that and stuff. Are those the elements you think that make true crime so popular, where it's, whether it's fiction or nonfiction?
That's definitely part of it, that these are big issues. This is what's bigger to those of us walking the earth than questions of life and death. And we have families, we have communities, and we want to know and understand, partly to protect ourselves and partly just to get a glimpse of, transgression, mm-hmm. because it's fascinating, sometimes shocking, sometimes baffling. We want to understand what makes people commit outrageous crimes. And certainly in true crime, we want to see how actual cases are resolved, because we still have a hunger for justice. And we have the certainly in real life, as in yes. a lot of crime fiction, we believe that justice is something that exists and can be sought and sometimes can be reached. So that's why we want to find out about these stories.
Now, you're a graduate of the Stanford Law School. You practiced law in Los Angeles, and then you taught writing. Where did the transition to crime novel author come in all of this?
It came from knowing from very early on that writing was something that I absolutely loved and hoped mm-hmm. to be able to do at some level in some way someday, because giving up on that, even if it only became a hobby, that seemed like it would be wasting something that was wonderful. So I practiced law. I did commercial litigation in Los Angeles. I wasn't a criminal lawyer, but eventually, when I was young and newly married and quickly had three small children, I decided that arguing for a living, going to court every day, wasn't what I wanted to do, burning the candle at both ends and the middle all the time. So I was offered a position teaching legal writing at the University of California, and I got to basically, I had carte blanche to create a course, and it was absolutely wonderful. And that kept me alive in the idea of that somewhere I was teaching writing, that was keeping my head in the game of writing, and that once I got the babies to sleep, maybe I could write on the side.
So when you were teaching, had you already started writing articles, or were they more scholarly legal issues?
I did a lot of every trial lawyer does a whole lot of writing, as I'm sure you know, that that every brief you submit to the court right. is a narrative. It's a story of how things have gone terribly wrong between people, and it's your job as a lawyer to tell that story in as compelling and persuasive a way as you can. I was then writing articles for small magazines that paid in copies. I was writing short stories. I had the idea for a caper novel that I was desperate to write, and that's when I realized I had no idea how to write a novel, that I had spent years writing every day. And so I had presumed that, well, I know how to write. But turning a story into a compelling plot with gripping characters that holds readers on the edge of their seat for 300 pages is a different discipline and takes a lot of practice.
Well, and not to mention the discipline of just sitting down at the keyboard in writing. I have to find that time of day and turn everything off. I'm sure you do too. And I presume you have a word count you're trying to achieve every day.
I do. And because I've been fortunate enough to have for many years to have book contracts, then I know when my deadline is. I know how long a novel is generally going to be, 90 to 100,000 words in my case. I know how long it takes to type those many words and then to revise the big steaming pile mm-hmm. of of junk that you initially create with your first draft. And so when I'm doing a first draft, I try to do 2,000 words a day. And I taught myself to do this by saying, don't edit, don't worry about it. They're just words. Get them down, put the story on the page, and then you can fix it.
All right, Meg, we're going to pause for a moment. And when we come back, let's talk about your other work. We're talking with Meg Gardner, and we're going to pick up with her series called UNSUB. And for our listeners, UNSUB is the FBI term for unknown subject. Meg, the first book, UNSUB, I've read it's kind of based on the Zodiac Killer. Is that correct?
It is. Every novel in the series has a kernel of a real case somewhere buried in it. And as a spark, as its genesis. And I grew up in California and can remember vaguely my parents being alarmed by this creature, this killer called Zodiac, and being shocked to have them tell me that this was somebody who killed people just because he enjoyed it. And that really rocked me as a little kid. And later on, when I was thinking about writing a thriller, it came to me the idea that the Zodiac went quiet but was never identified. May still be out there. The Zodiac has never been identified or apprehended officially, and has certainly not been brought to justice. So I thought, being an author who lets her mind spin out, if an infamous, a notorious cold case suddenly went hot again after 20 years, what would happen? So that was the origin of UNSUB, about a Bay Area serial killer cult prophet who disappeared and seems to have been resurrected now 20 years after his last killing.
And of course, he taunted police and everybody with these cryptic messages and symbols that, as a group recently have said they've decoded them. Some people think they've identified someone that's deceased. Do you buy it? Do you think we really know who this was?
I think law enforcement has some top suspects. I don't know that they are ever going to definitively name that person. I know that a number of retired detectives still feel haunted by the case, that they were never able to identify the killer and bring him to justice, and that it is it clings to them even in retirement.
So you introduce Caitlin Hendricks, a narcotics detective in UNSUB, and then she evolves into an FBI profiler in your second book, Into the Black Nowhere, which I also read was inspired by Ted Bundy. It's set in Texas, but it really sounded a lot like the serial killer Kenneth McDuff that we've done our television series about and the podcast about. Really fit him, what he was doing. Tell us about how that serial killer was operating and how much of it is inspired by real life.
I was fascinated by the way someone like Ted Bundy completely masked his homicidal mania, not psychiatrically, but how he masked his killings under a veneer of being seemingly the kind of young man that a lot of parents would have been happy to have their daughters bring home for Sunday dinner in that era. That he was polite, he was well spoken, well dressed, he was well educated. He volunteered. Well, no, he worked for a crisis hotline, and apparently was his coworkers, including Ann Rule,
I knew Anne.
Thought that he was an empathetic and effective counselor under extreme stress. He worked for the governor of Washington. So people were looking at this seemingly model of clean-cut manhood and thinking he had promise. But of course, it was all a mask. And I wondered, how would you strip that mask off of someone? And Caitlin, and the heroine of the series, hunts serial predators. So I thought, here's someone who's charming, who is seemingly successful, who nobody wants to believe could be a killer. How would she and her team go about undercutting that and getting the evidence and bringing him to justice?
And she becomes a profiler. How did you kind of get in the head of profiling to be authentic in as you do with her and what she does?
I read all of John Douglas's books, Mindhunter, yeah, and the rest of that. Number one, that sounds flip, but it's true. You read up on the work of people who spent decades developing the profession and doing the work. And I also have taken a couple of workshops run by the FBI specifically for writers to help us understand what the mm-hmm. Bureau's work is like in various fields.
Yeah, I knew one of the original profilers for sex crimes was Roy Hazelwood. Roy is has passed. But he really was able to help me when back 30 years ago when I was chasing Kenneth McDuff. And it was just amazing the insights and how they could examine a crime scene and extrapolate a profile mm-hmm. of the criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's working backwards from crime scene evidence because it's a simple but not obvious insight that the criminal and the victim must cross paths, and that you're going to find evidence of that at the crime scene. And you can use that intersection to extrapolate as much as possible and narrow down the pool of people who you can focus your efforts on.
So your third book in the Unsub series, Dark Corners of the Night, now you've got a serial killer named the Midnight Man who is killing parents but leaving the children unharmed. What is it you think that is so compelling about serial killer stories? And in my podcast, that they're the top listened to. And in our television show, that's what really everybody, you know, was just taken by. What do you think that psychological phenomenon? Are we all sitting there wondering, is there a serial killer inside me potentially, or my significant other asleep next to me?
One hopes not, but I've spoken to psychiatrists and asked them what they think the intrigue is, and they say, well, we're as fascinated as everybody else. Part of it, I think, is wanting to see a glimpse into people who are so transgressive, who break every bound that that society sets, who kill for thrill or for some kind of mission or for some kind of pleasure, not the ordinary, seeming so ordinary motives such as money or love or revenge, that most people I don't think are looking to find out if they think they fit the mold of a serial killer, although the family of the Happy Face killer has said that he did watch a lot of true crime shows possibly too, because he thought he was so much smarter than all the killers who were getting caught on those shows. That in hindsight, that's why he loved those shows. But I think part of it is the idea that if we can possibly understand what makes someone a killer who lives among us, who is generally part of society, who might be your next door neighbor, how can we protect ourselves? That if we educate and keep ourselves alert, that we won't become a victim.
Well, I always get to ask the question, why? What is making them tick? Why do they do these things? And I really can't ever come up with any kind of an explanation that makes any sense.
No. And that makes them extra scary, because it's nothing that you could forestall or head off. Mm-hmm. It's in a novel, that makes them, of course, a ruthless antagonist. Mm-hmm. Someone who is not just going to suddenly decide that, okay, maybe instead of, you know, doing killings, I'm going to, you know, yeah, open a pet rescue center instead. Sure. So, but we as a people, I think, are just fascinated with getting a glimpse into a world that we want to reassure ourselves we would never fall into, in a way. And again, the stakes are very high if you have a killer who can't be dissuaded from what, yeah, they're doing.
Well, now you have another series, Evan Delaney, those novels, and that features a journalist. Tell me how you approach that. Me being a journalist makes me interested.
That was my first series, my first novel, China Lake. I was extremely delighted to won the Edgar for Best Paperback Original. And that was a novel that I just had an idea for a story. And I set out to write it about a young woman who, at the time, I was like, I'm gonna start writing crime series, thrillers. What'll I do? I lived in Southern California. I'll set it in Southern California. I'm a woman. I'll have a female protagonist. I was in law and am now writing. So I don't have to do too much research. Perhaps I'll have her be a journalist with a legal background. So I don't stumble over anything. And I just had an idea for a story about this young woman who was caring for her first grade nephew while his dad was deployed as a naval aviator, and that the little boy's estranged mother joins an apocalyptic cult and decides that she wants to bring her son into it as well. So then it becomes a family drama, a protect the kid drama, and sort out several murders drama. And I had no idea what I was doing, except I wanted it to be a thrilling story. And I knew that I had to set the bar extremely high and clear it so that I could reach a publishable level, and fortunately did. And then I was shocked when they said, how about a sequel? My publisher said, how about a sequel? So that's how it became a series.
Well, Stephen King surely liked it. He said it was the finest crime suspense series he'd ever come across in the last 20 years at the time. Boy, that must have made you feel great, you know, just coming out of the gate with this.
It knocked me flat. And it, you know, Stephen King, I have nothing but gratitude for him, that he really pays it forward to so many other writers and artists, and that opened a lot of doors for me. And he'll always be the man in my eyes.
And then you have another series, Joe Beckett. Joe Beckett is a forensic psychiatrist. Again, you've got to become a forensic psychiatrist creating and working on these crimes. Did you have to talk to a lot of forensic psychiatrists or read a lot of material?
I spoke to a lot of psychiatrists found one forensic psychiatrist who I could rely on to be willing to extend his expertise and knowledge and insight to me. So that was really important to me, to understand again what the job is really like, to give respect to the people who do the work, to give respect to the doctors, the law enforcement, the families of victims, and make it an exciting and entertaining and informative story, but that also feels grounded in the real world. And it was just, it's just fascinating to get inside the minds of people. I mean, I'm yes. sure you know that as well, that a psychiatrist friend says they went into this that specialty because they can think of nothing that is more fascinating than the human mind.
Well, was there anything you learned from them about the criminal mind that just like knocked you out of the chair?
Nothing about the criminal mind in particular. It was more about how they approach understanding victims. Because what Joe in the novels does, and what forensic psychiatrists sometimes do, is perform psychological autopsies, which means that they're the last resort in cases that the evidence can't identify whether a death is literally accident, natural, suicide, or homicide. So it's how they understand psychology, how they understand death statistics, how they reconstruct a timeline of the person's life, how they investigate whether someone had enemies. I mean, you know, you get crushed by a bus. Did you trip off the curb? did you throw yourself there in despair, or did someone push you? So that's that was fascinating to me, to see how you would try to sort out all those threads and come to a conclusion that could help the family and the justice system determine what had really happened.
Well, I know the fans of Heat, the movie, listening to this, they've got to be wondering, Heat 2, is there another movie coming? What do you think?
Well, Michael Mann, my brilliant co-author and progenitor of the entire project, has said that he sees this as a big movie, and who am I to to contradict anything that he says?
And what was it like collaborating with him?
It was brilliant. It was challenging. I felt a lot of responsibility, felt a weight on my shoulders, knowing that I was going to be working with someone who had who was an icon of mine to begin with, for all his work in film mm-hmm. and television, and who had written and directed Heat, which is the greatest heist movie ever yes. made. And that he knew these characters, he knew their stories, and that he wanted to expand something that has become a classic into the before and after of that world. And that if I was going to take on his characters and get inside of them, that it was a privilege and a responsibility, but working with him was exhilarating, and I knew I had to bring my A game every single minute, which is a great challenge to have.
How did the two of you meet or come together to collaborate?
He had the concept for writing Heat 2 as a novel, and we have the same literary agent. And after Michael read Unsub, he wanted to speak to me about that. I mean, he's an extraordinarily accomplished writer. Until now, his work has all been in film and television, which is quite a different discipline than writing a story in novel form at 400 pages, you know, 120,000 words. So he wanted to collaborate, as he's done on film. He wanted to collaborate with a writer who had experience working in that arena. And so we just we circled each other and talked and worked it out and threw ourselves into the task.
Was there a particular character for the movie that you were very interested in? Like mine was Val Kilmer. I'd like to know more of the Val Kilmer story.
Exactly. And lucky for you, you learn more of that in Heat 2. Val Kilmer plays Chris Chehurlis, the second in command in Neil McCauley's crew. We find out they're very close. They're brothers from another mm-hmm. mother, in a sense. And Chris is the loan. This is not terribly spoilerish after decades to say that Chris is the last survivor of the crew after Heat. So the book opens the next day with him near dead from a gunshot wound after this massive battle with the LAPD in the streets of downtown Los Angeles, desperate to escape. Al Pacino's character is hunting him. And what's he going to do? He knows he's going to have to abandon his life in America if he's going to live another day, that he's going to have to leave his family behind for their safety as well as his own. Where's he going to go? What's he going to do? So we that sets up the story. And then it goes back in time to how he and Neil are living big, vivid lives and taking down big, exciting scores.
Did Michael Mann share anything with you about the staging of that gun battle in Heat, which is the kind of gun battle of all gun battles in crime shows?
Yes, but a lot of it is material that if you read interviews with him, mm-hmm. follow the director's commentary on the movie and so forth, you can find out as well that he had all the actors train ahead of filming with the former SAS operators at the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department firing range with a maniacal focus on safety. He's keen to make sure everyone understands, but to learn how to look realistic. And and they did that. The shootout, they had to do it on weekends because they really filmed it it's not filmed on a studio lot. It's filmed on the streets of downtown Los Angeles. So they had to close off the streets, and they could only do that usually on a Sunday morning. So they had to try to get the weather to match. They had to set all those shot up police cars back in place, get everybody back in their costumes. And I will say that as far as authenticity, a friend of mine who's a former U.S. Marine Corps officer said that they watched that scene to learn how to conduct a bounding overwatch by seeing how Val Kilmer loads, reloads, and repels an ambush in that scene in the movie.
Well, Meg, what's next for you? Is there more in the Unsub series, or are you going another direction?
Well, I do have another Unsub book that will be out in 2023, and then setting out on we'll see what. Now that Heat 2 is on bookshelves, it's time to launch myself into another thriller. So more news on that soon.
I have to ask, as a fellow writer, do you wake up in the middle of the night with this stuff running through your head?
Absolutely, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I always keep that notepad beside me. And my problem is I can't go back to sleep. I've got to stay up for 2 hours and get it all out, you know?
Yes. And I've learned I also have a flashlight, because if you just try to scribble it down in the dark, then it doesn't make any sense in the morning. You need to make sure that your writing is legible. But waking up is, your unconscious mind does a lot of work for you. Putting connections together and solving problems that sometimes we don't see when we're sitting at the keyboard.
Well, Meg, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. I want our listeners to know that you can find all of her books wherever they're sold: Unsub, Heat 2, Dark Corners of the Night from Unsub, which is being made into a movie, the Joe Beckett series. I recommend it all. It's really good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bank heists were once the quintessential American crime, immortalized with the daring exploits of Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, and Pretty Boy Floyd. In the wake of high-tech surveillance cameras that capture sharp images and hardened cages for tellers, most criminals today have decided bank robbery no longer pays. The FBI even released a bank robbers app so the public could scroll through the photos of suspects to help identify them. As a result, the bank robbery rate has dramatically dropped, and gone are the days when you could get away with hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's now largely a crime of the desperate. But it will continue to grip the public imagination in books like Heat 2 by Meg Gardner and Michael Mann. I want to remind our listeners to sign up for our true crime community on our website at truecrimereporter.com. There's a red box on every page where you can sign up. And also, I'm putting links in the show notes to my stories about the bank robbery shootouts in Los Angeles. We want to be your favorite true crime podcast, so please recommend us to your friends and leave a review wherever you listen. If you want to receive updates and bonus interviews, join our true crime community at truecrimereporter.com. If you have suggestions or know of a case that we should look into, email us at fan@truecrimereporter.com. This podcast is a trademarked and copyrighted news organization based in Dallas, Texas. You can read more about our news team at truecrimereporter.com. Thanks for listening to our journey into darkness.